From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Romney and Gingrich battle in Florida. President Obama rolls out his big campaign themes. Cutbacks coming at the Pentagon, and SEAL Team 6 is on the job again. It's not class warfare, the president said in his State of the Union address, but he does want higher taxes on the rich.
Now, you can call this class warfare all you want, but asking a billionaire to pay at least as much as his secretary in taxes? Most Americans would call that common sense.
Romney backers called Newt Gingrich erratic this week. In Florida, Gingrich painted Romney anti-immigrant. Mitt came out swinging in debate last night.
Mr. Speaker, I'm not anti-immigrant. My father was born in Mexico. My wife's father was born in Wales. They came to this country. The idea that I'm anti-immigrant is repulsive.
And SEAL Team 6, the unit that killed bin Laden, back on the job in Somalia this week, rescuing two kidnapped aid workers, one American. Here's ABC with a simulation.
Within minutes after sneaking into the encampment, the SEALs were facing a barrage of gunfire. The SEALs moved quickly, killing all nine heavily armed kidnappers.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with National Journal's Major Garrett, Carl Hyacin of Florida, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. Who is it going to be in Florida? Will it be Mr. Moonbase, Mr. Millions? What do you make of the president's opening volley, in the campaign of Gabby Gifford's goodbye, of Joe Paterno's? Joining us this week is Major Garrett, White House correspondent for National Journal. He's been down in Florida writing questions for the first GOP debate this week and in Washington for the State of the Union. Sharp as they come. Major Garrett, welcome back to On Point.
Always great to be with you, Tom.
And with us from Fort Pierce, Florida, on the pounding Atlantic, Mr. Florida, Carl Hyacin, longtime investigative reporter, then columnist for the Miami Herald, big-time Florida thriller writer. Star Island, Nature Girl, Skinny Dip, his next book, due out in March, is Chump. Carl Hyacin, welcome back to you as well. Great to have you with us.
And hi, Tom. Thanks for having me back.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, ever-present Eye on the World, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Major, and Carl.
Carl Hyacin, you're our Florida guy. You're watching this. It looks neck and neck like crazy from outside. We're down to the wire now. How do you read what's going on after all the campaigning, all the shouting? Where does it look like it's headed, Carl?
Well, I think the next couple of days are going to be crucial, because we're getting, those of us who live down here are getting swamped with attack ads. I mean, that's all it is attack ads. And we'll see if they have any effect. So close that, whoever spends the most money is going to end up winning.
You've got a good feel for things. I mean, we saw how South Carolina felt, and they went for that very visceral Gingrich kind of take on the world. There's Romney. He was pretty aggressive and tough last night, but not that same viscera out there. How does Florida respond to the Gingrich magic?
Well, it's not as monolithic, or it's not as easy to call as South Carolina or New Hampshire or Iowa. I mean, this is a state of 18 million people that you could geographically and demographically cut up probably into four or five different states. So it's very hard to read. You have to work the regions from the panhandle to South Florida is totally different. You know, it's just not that easy to call. And I think a few years ago, everybody said that Giuliani was going to, waltz through Florida and take the nomination. Mm-hmm. And instead, he withered up and died here. So it's not easy to predict.
Major Garrett, you watch closely. You big debate last night on Monday night, National Journal, NBC, Tampa Bay Times were sponsors. You were down there cranking out questions. What do you see unfolding here, Major?
Well, before that debate, I had a conversation with Bob Martinez, former governor of Florida, Republican, still involved in Florida politics. He said, the thing that strikes me about this experience that everyone in Florida is going through, and his comments were entirely related to Florida, but I think they are worth considering at the larger national level as Republicans have gone through this process. Mm-hmm. He said, I see lots of energy, but the core attachment I see to candidates has never been more shallow or transient. He said, in Florida, Republicans move back and forth and have moved back and forth very quickly. And as he was saying that was Monday night, the shift was to Gingrich. Mm-hmm. There were four polls taken in Florida right after the South Carolina primary that instantly had Gingrich not just closing the 19 or 15-point gap with Romney, but exceeding it, leading Romney by six or seven. Well, now there have been six polls taken since Tuesday or Wednesday showing Romney back on top. So that process that Bob Martinez was describing Monday has actually played out in full in Florida in the next 4 days. That doesn't mean that Gingrich can't have a snapback moment, but right now the momentum in the polling data appears to be with Romney. And I think as Carl will appreciate, his campaign has taken very careful notice of the easy early voting laws in Florida and has packed away a sizable number of votes already. And as we learned from the gubernatorial election in Florida last year on the Republican side in the primary, Bill McCollum, the establishment quote-unquote candidate, won on Election Day but lost the early vote and therefore lost the primary.
I mean, it is pretty wild. The polls last night, Jack Beatty, had Gingrich edging and more than edging Mitt Romney out of Florida. Now this morning we're reading the latest round. Here's one from Quinnipiac with Romney 38%, Gingrich 29%. You know, Carl and Major are talking about this sliding back and forth, the shallowness of devotion here, Jack. You can see that the candidates feel that and how hard they were fighting last night.
Yes, and I think on any fair estimate, Mitt Romney had a strong night, and Newt Gingrich didn't seem to show up. That seemed to be the consensus even of the Republican callers, experts on the talk shows afterwards. Why that was, I don't know. Why Newt couldn't do something similar. He couldn't, for example, he didn't perform. He tried once with Wolf Blitzer to perform his, you know, jujitsu.
Pushback,
on the,
yeah.
Yes, on the media. That didn't work. And he was really devastated when he was taxing Romney. He was saying, you know, you have invested in Freddie and Fannie. And he came, and Romney came back and he said, well, it's a blind trust. I don't know anything about it. He said, but Mr. Speaker, did you know that you have invested in them? And he didn't know.
Right.
And, you know, that just showed what opposition research, which you have to pay for, does. Newt is running this this campaign out of his back pocket, it seems. He can't get on the ballot in his home state, can't get on the ballot in Missouri, other places, and he can't even do the opposition research or can't prepare to defend himself against it because he just doesn't have the wherewithal.
Easy to point that out, and yet he had a head of steam not very long ago. Mitt Romney was tough last night. Newt Gingrich had been out talking with NASA folks in Florida, famous NASA country, and saying, we will build a moon base, a space colony, get 13,000 people up there. They can even vote. People came out to mock him, saying 51st state. Mitt Romney went after him last night after this idea of a permanent American colony on the moon, saying that there was a pattern of pandering and maybe worse here.
I spent 25 years in business. If I had a business executive come to me and say they wanted to spend a few hundred billion dollars to put a colony on the moon, I'd say you're fired. The idea that corporate America wants to go off to the moon and build a colony there, it may be a big idea, but it's not a good idea.
Moon base, moon bat. Major Garrett, you've been talking about how establishment Republicans have come out of the woodwork this week after the big South Carolina Gingrich victory to go after Gingrich. What are they saying, Major?
Well, they're saying a couple of things. The erratic charge is not new. The electorally dangerous charge is really the new one that's come out. And Bob Dole, a figure of eminence and probity, if you will, in the Republican Party, released a letter yesterday saying if Newt Gingrich is the nominee, down-ballot Republicans will suffer and we don't have a chance of winning the White House. So not only will we not win the White House, but members of Congress, Senate candidates, and possibly legislative candidates will lose as well. And that's something that Republicans now are saying in greater numbers on the conservative sort of blogosphere. You're seeing that more and more. And it has been described by the Gingrich camp as abject panic, and as they say, it reinforces Gingrich's stature as an outsider. Of course, I mean, this outsider label is extremely flexible. As you mentioned,
yes.
Or someone mentioned, he lives in Virginia, Newt Gingrich does, right next, right near the nation's capital. He has been in either academia or Washington as a member of Congress or the larger Washington consultancy culture for 30 years. I mean, he is the last credible articulator of a person as an outsider. He is the quintessential insider.
Yeah,
but because he talks in a way that channels Republican voter, primary voter frustration about these larger institutions, he can for a while hold that mantle. The problem for Gingrich, and I've watched this in his entire career, Newt Gingrich is a nimble, effective, memorable insurgent.
Mm.
He is not nearly as effective as an actual holder, possessor, and manager of power. And we're seeing that play out a little bit in Florida as well.
Listen to this. This was Steve Schmidt, who was a big advisor to John McCain in his campaign 4 years ago, talking on MSNBC on Saturday, predicting that if Newt wins in Florida, watch out in the GOP.
If Newt Gingrich is able to win the Florida primary, you will see a panic and a meltdown of the Republican establishment that is beyond my ability to articulate in the English language. People will go crazy. And you will have this five-week period until the Super Tuesday states that's just going to be as unpredictable, tumultuous as any period in modern American politics.
Panic, meltdown in the GOP, says big GOP guy right there. Carl Hiaasen, what about it? Is Newt looking, you know, maybe Moonbase sounds good to a lot of Floridians. Those are
no,
jobs.
No, it doesn't. It sounds nutty to Floridians. It doesn't sound good to them at all. I mean, Florida, we have almost 10% unemployment here. It sounds like a Looney Tune. This is what the problem with Newt. He comes up with this stuff off the top of his head. Here's the thing. Within the Republican Party in Florida, as nationally, he has many enemies. There's no fountain of goodwill for this guy going back to the 90s. It's not just the establishment idea. He's a mean-spirited guy. He's burned a lot of bridges. He's ticked a lot of people off. I wrote a column that'll be in Sunday's Herald about, I mean, if you're a Democrat right now and you're watching the ascendancy of Newt Gingrich, all you're doing is pinching yourself and saying, this is too good to be true. You know, there are scuff marks in the Oval Office on the ceiling from Obama doing cartwheels, thinking about running against this guy.
I don't know, but we'll see soon enough. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking about a week in the news, Romney-Gingrich showdown in Florida. The president launches his campaign. Big cuts for the U.S. military. SEAL Team 6 back at work in Somalia. We're joined by Major Garrett of National Journal. He's been down in Florida this week in the thick of debates there. Carl Hiaasen, who knows and lives Florida inside out, has for a long time. Look for his latest book, Chump, out in March. Jack Beatty's here as well. Here's little Newt Gingrich at the University of North Florida in Jacksonville last night, defending his role, not as lobbyist, he said, as an advisor to Freddie Mac, saying Romney had no room to talk about Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac.
We discovered to our shock, Governor Romney owns shares of both Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Governor Romney made $1 million off of selling some of that. Governor Romney owns share and has an investment in Goldman Sachs, which is today foreclosing on Floridians.
There's Gingrich in English. Here's his ad in Spanish going after Mitt Romney on the immigrant front, comparing Mitt Romney to Fidel Castro. The ad was later pulled after criticism from Republican Senator Marco Rubio. The ad begins with the voice of Fidel Castro.
Patria o muerte, venceremos.
Asombrosamente, esta frase también fue usada por Mitt Romney.
Mitt Romney es un liberal del Estado y al estilo de Kennedy.
Él es el candidato. Hey, here you go. Fidel Castro saying, homeland or death, we shall overcome. And the narrator saying, amazingly, this phrase was also used by Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney is a liberal in the same style and from the same state as Kennedy, the most anti-immigrant candidate. And on it goes. Then, by contrast, it says, Newt Gingrich is a candidate who's committed himself to the Hispanic people and experienced Ronald Reagan Republican. Major Garrett, you've covered Newt Gingrich for a long time. Is this the Ronald Reagan Republican?
Well, I'm really not going to arbitrate that for the Republican field. What I can tell you is what I watched and what I observed when Newt Gingrich was in the minority and when he became Speaker. I've written a book about the 1994 election, what led up to it, Gingrich's role in that and the role of many other Republicans and all the policy that came from it. And I will tell you this. In the House of Representatives and among Republicans generally, Newt Gingrich pursued a majority for Republicans, control of the gavel, the speakership, to complete what he thought was the unfinished domestic agenda of Ronald Reagan, things that were not accomplished in the Reagan years, either on domestic policy chiefly described or personified by welfare reform, building a stronger national defense, specifically ballistic missile defense, and tax cuts for families and others, capital gains and other things. So those were all aspects of what he thought Ronald Reagan would have done had he been president and had a compliant or cooperative Republican Congress. So in that large sense, I think Newt Gingrich created or helped create a Republican majority in pursuit of goals and policies he believed were a natural extension of the Reagan years. Does that make him the pure Reaganaut? Of course not. And what people forget, and I wrote about this on nationaljournal.com, people think back when Reagan was actually president that Republicans ran around Washington and the nation constantly and fervently singing his praises. It's not true. Republicans criticized President Reagan quite a bit because at times, tactically and on policy, they felt he either deviated from conservatism or just screwed things up. So when you find these isolated quotes of Gingrich, quote-unquote, denouncing Reagan, he was not alone. That doesn't mean he was an apostate. It doesn't mean he tried to undermine the Reagan administration. And in the main, I think, certainly compared to Mitt Romney, you would say Gingrich is closer to the Reagan aspect of the party than Romney.
You know, Carl Hyacin-Vec, earlier in the month, you were writing about Mitt Romney. You wrote it. He wins here, that is, in Florida, your home state, in a cakewalk, if, and then you've got this whole, if he isn't struck by lightning or swallowed by a sinkhole, if he doesn't get caught with a loaded Glock at a South Beach nightclub, picture Mitt Romney with it, if he doesn't hit on LeBron James' fiance, if he doesn't sneak off to the Bahamas on a yacht named Monkey Business. What about the immigrant issue? Why is Newt Gingrich going after that? Romney's talked about self-deportation. Explain this whole formula around immigrants and immigration for us down there, Carl. How's it
Well, playing? It's tricky. I mean, Romney's, I think, gotten a little more sensitive about being accused of flip-flopping. So he has sort of stuck to the position, you know, and I think both these candidates have come out in favor of the Dream, against the Dream Act.
That is to let young, even if they're not citizens, let young Latinos, Latinas in this country go to college, help them.
That's an incredibly unpopular position in Florida to take, but it's
you mean
it's
to be been, for that or against that?
To be against that in South Florida is not going to help them any. I think the I think that Gingrich is in a little better position because he's advocated what I don't think he would call an amnesty, but basically an amnesty for people that have been here a while, which is more popular. I mean, I don't know. The rallies I've seen, some of the polls I've seen down here, I think immigration in Florida, as much as it is an assimilated and assimilating state, I'm not sure it's a number one issue, and I'm not sure that's what people are going to be voting on. It really is the economy. And even at the rallies, you see when they walk into the crowd and interview, and yeah, they cheer when you talk about overthrowing Castro and all that, and they cheer this and that, but at the bottom of it all is we need jobs, we need to get the economy turned around. So I'm not sure that's going to be the major thing in Florida as much as you would think otherwise.
Let's get our listeners in here. Mark in Nashville, Tennessee, you're on the air. Thanks for calling, Mark.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
I have a comment and a question for Carl Hyacin. First of all, by disclaimer, I'm a big fan.
Me too.
Secondly, we're glad that Rick Scott self-deported himself from Nashville to Florida. And thirdly, and this is my question, assuming y'all allow crossover voting down there, do you see a lot of Democrats doing cartwheels to get into the voting booth to vote for Gingrich?
No, there is no – you can't – they can't vote in this – there's no crossover voting. You have to be a registered Republican. I see them – I mean, I jokingly told someone I wouldn't be surprised to see them donating to the Gingrich campaign at this point, hoping to keep it alive. But no, there is no crossover in Florida. You mentioned Rick Scott. I've never seen this in all my years in Florida.
He's the current governor of Florida. Yeah,
right. Scott. He's a Republican. He ran sort of as a Tea Party candidate. He spent $78 million of his own money. Woo. He came from a corporation that had just paid the biggest fine for Medicare fraud of any in the history of Medicare fraud. Huge amount of baggage, but he came in and won. But you won't see any of the candidates with him. And in fact, there's an ad running that paints Romney and puts Romney and Scott photoshopped together, referring to a company that Romney once had that had been fined for Medicare fraud as well. And it basically is trying to slur Romney by connecting him to a sitting Republican governor in the state. I've never seen that before.
Watch out for that. What about the early voting, Carl? Newt and Mitt have swapped places, gone up and down. What if a bunch of those votes came in when Newt was riding high?
I think Romney's going to have an edge. He's got an organization. You got to remember that Newt's being bankrolled principally at this point by the Adelsons.
Sheldon Adelson, the big casino owner. And his wife.
And they're paying for most of the ads that are going on now. And Newt did not have the on-the-ground organization that Romney had. And I think – I don't think – however it plays out, Romney's going to have a big advantage in the early voting and in the absentee balloting.
It is amazing. One man and maybe his wife, bankrolling one man. And off we go to the top of the polls. Laura in Dedham, Massachusetts. Laura, you're on the air.
Hi. I had two quick questions, which maybe you could address one or both. Mm-hmm. One is that I haven't heard anyone discuss what I heard Ann Romney say. She said to an audience that when my husband asked me something like, you know, should I run? Is it okay if I run? And I said to him one question, can you save us? And he said yes. And you know, I don't know if that's very cynical or if that's nuts, but I find it concerning.
Save us as in save the country.
Yes, can you save us?
Yeah, all of us.
The United States.
Yeah.
And then the other question is, I also haven't seen anyone discuss the new way of apportioning that the Republican Party is using, and that seems kind of progressive to me, that they're not doing a winner-take-all, and I don't
you mean
know
of delegates in the primary contests, I guess,
yes.
Laura. Mm-hmm. And how does that end up? Major, let me bring it to you. I mean, can you save us? Yeah, that's a pretty big question, but
kind of a high bar, don't you think?
Yeah. On the other hand, a lot of people feel like that's what the country needs right now. And what about the apportioning and the idea that we're seeing that if Newt should come in ahead, this could just roll, maybe even if he doesn't in this state, but that this rolls on and on and on for months, even to a brokered convention, even with Jeb Bush in there somehow at some point.
Right. Well, let me try not to get too deeply in the weeds on this. Right now it is declared by the chief counsel, the chief lawyer for the Republican National Committee that Florida is a winner-take-all state. It has 100 delegates. It moved its primary up, and so it was, by party rules, lost 50 of those delegates. So 50 delegates, according to the RNC right now, are up for grabs as a winner-take-all proposition. However, there are committeemen in Florida whom I've spoken to who say the actual granular rules of the party say those delegates should be awarded on a proportional basis because that's the actual real binding sanction the party applied to big states like Florida to discourage them from jumping ahead, which Florida did, moved its primary date up. Now, this week, privately, there were discussions at the legal beagle level from both Romney and Gingrich because both candidates thought, well, wait a minute. If it's winner take all and I come in a strong second, I would much rather have this to be proportional so I get some delegates out of this. The Romney campaign had originally been, no. The RNC says it's all winner take all.
Right.
Midweek this week when they thought they might come in a strong second, they began to quietly say, well, maybe we could do this on a proportional basis.
Romney the dealmaker at work, yeah.
So this is still being teased out, and there may be a challenge. Ultimately, as Carl knows, as all of us knows, if Romney wins Florida, goes on to secure the nomination somewhat comfortably, all the delegates will be reinstated. That's what always happens. But this has become a kind of a ripple in the universe in Florida behind the scenes.
Jack, I've got to get your big take here. A couple calls from Iowa first, maybe. David in Newton, Iowa. You're on the air, David.
Sure. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as far as the winner take all, I think this is going to end up being closer and stretch out well, probably well beyond Super Tuesday. There's no way that anybody has enough momentum after Florida to you know, not make Super
Lock
Tuesday.
Lock it up.
Florida.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I think with Gingrich, he plays well when he's running against the press. And in this debate last night, I didn't catch it all, but it looked like he didn't really have any opportunity to do that, so that hurt him. And then finally, talk a little bit about Santorum. I think if Santorum pulls up near 20% in Florida and it turns out to be proportional, he's still in there.
We'll look at that, David. I appreciate it. He tried with Wolf Blitzer last night. Wolf pushed back pretty effectively, and that was kind of that. One more, Chad in Burlington, Iowa. Chad, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my time.
Yeah.
Call, Tom.
Yeah.
Just want to make a general observation. I am a pro-Obama supporter, and I am loving it. Let the candidates, GOP candidates, tear each other apart while in the background President Obama is raising record amounts of numbers of fundraising for his efforts. Let's get him in the White House for four more years and let him finish the job of cleaning up the mess that the Republicans left him before he was elected.
And you're thinking
my response off the air.
Got it, Chad. And you're thinking maybe that's where he's headed with Republicans tussling. But I don't know. They've bought themselves a lot of screen time here and a lot of attention. Jack Beatty, step back with us here. We've got the president this week with his State of the Union address and then right out to big swing states, effectively beginning his campaign in earnest this week. At the same time, you've got this big rumble on the GOP side. How do you see holistically here, Jack, this working up?
Well, Tom, first on the DREAM Act, it just happened sort of by the way, but in Monday's debate, both Gingrich and Romney came out for a version of the DREAM Act, which would limit it to people in the military. The Obama and the Democrats' idea was that both anyone going to college and or the military, both Romney and Gingrich came out for just the military. So that was a modification of their position on the DREAM Act, I think one that's probably important. You know, this week on Fox News, Karl Rove said, stop, stop, you're only damaging your chances in the general election to the both the candidates. Mm-hmm. And there's evidence that that is happening. Mitt Romney, in a month, has seen his unfavorables among blue-collar, white working-class voters increase by 20 points in a month. He lost those voters pretty much by 20 points in the Republican primary in South Carolina. Meanwhile, Mitt's flares at Newt, influence peddler, resigned in disgrace, yep, erratic, and so on, that's produced the situation that we see. Peter Hart headlines it in today's, talking about the NBC poll, Gingrich is Goldwater, that he's losing to Obama by 18 points. So there's some evidence that that Gingrich's attacks on Romney, on the Bain capital, and on his money and Goldman Sachs, Swiss bank accounts, and so on, that that's getting traction among blue-collar, white, working-class voters. And there's also evidence that the already poisonous atmosphere for Newt Gingrich has been rendered toxic by the Romney attack.
Interesting. Those Romney Mega Millions and taxes, a lot for everybody to chew on there, I guess. Eric in Boynton Beach, Florida. Thanks for calling, Eric. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks. I wanted to raise a couple of points about the space policy stuff of Newt Gingrich. This is not a guy who's actually just kind of like making a statement just to grab for the Florida and then running off with it.
He's a space enthusiast. Mm-hmm.
Pardon?
He is a space enthusiast. Has been for a while.
Yes, he is. He's been on the board of governors of the National Space Society for years. Every single Ad Astra magazine has him listed on there. And I'm a little tired of people actually laughing about the space policy itself, especially since China is on its way to try to build a lunar base on the moon.
Do you think we need or should have a lunar space colony, maybe with 13,000 people, as Newt Gingrich says, and ultimately the right to vote up there and all the rest, Eric?
Yes. If we actually put that, we will become the Saudi Arabia of the 21st, 22nd, and 23rd centuries.
What's the oil up there? What do they send back that makes us Saudi rich?
Helium-3.
Helium?
It is an element that will actually be useful for making fusion reactors. We have scientists of American know-how that knows how to make use of it for fusion reactors here on Earth. You can talk to Gerald Kolsinski of the University of Wisconsin in Madison, because he's got designs to do it. He can't really experiment with it, since there is no helium-3 on Earth.
Eric, we've got it, and I appreciate your call with some trepidation. I have to go to our Floridian and humorist, Carl Hyacin. Gently, Carl, there's enthusiasm for helium-3 and bring it back and all the rest.
If they could do that, maybe first they could rebuild I-95 and some of the bridges and infrastructure in this country and then get around to the moon. Or maybe just take the professor from Wisconsin up there. It would be a little cheaper than building a whole colony and give him some tanks and let him bring it back. But in a country that's on the edge of was on the edge of physical collapse a few short years ago, it's a hard sell.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, 1 year, Wednesday, since the uprising in Egypt began, it's not over, said a protester in Cairo this week.
We can't start something 1 year ago, 12 months ago, and watch 1,000 people die and thousands of people sit in military prisons for the same reason that we all took to the streets 1 year ago.
Longtime Penn State football coach Joe Paterno fired after a child sex abuse scandal that scarred his reputation as the winningest coach in college football died Sunday at 85. Despite it all, a big outpouring for Joe Pa.
Aside from all that's happened, this is different. It's all the people that have come to pay respects to him, and it's Joe was Penn State.
And Oscar nominations out this week. Martin Scorsese's Hugo and its Dream of Paris sat at the top of the pack with 11 nominations, including for Best Original Score. We're looking at a week in the news. Romney Gingrich showdown in Florida. The president launches his campaign. Big cuts for the U.S. Army, some for Marine SEAL Team 6. Back at work in Somalia, Carl Hyacin is with us from Fort Pierce, Florida. Columnist for the Miami Herald and author of, oh, you name it, Star Island Nature Girl Chomp comes out in March. Major Garrett is with us, White House correspondent for National Journal. Joins us from Washington, been down in Florida. Jack Beatty's in here. Let's go to Sam in Lincoln, Massachusetts. Sam, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I was wondering what the guests think about Obama's, how he's going to run his campaign in 2012, given his State of the Union address, which seemed, to my ears, very cynical to people who are hoping for hope and change. So what's his pitch going to be this time? I don't think he'll be able to fool people twice with hope and change. So is all he has not Romney or better than Romney? How's he going to swing us?
Yeah, there's a jaundiced view of the president. Let's listen to the way he put his theme, and we'll see what our guests think about it today, Sam. Here's the president on Tuesday night in his State of the Union address.
We can either settle for a country where a shrinking number of people do really well, while a growing number of Americans barely get by. Or we can restore an economy where everyone gets a fair shot and everyone does their fair share and everyone plays by the same set of rules.
Fair shot, fair share, same rules for everybody. Carl Hyacin, what do you make of the president's big message this week?
I mean, I'm not as nationally aware of as our other guests are, but I mean, I think anything that plays to jobs is good in Florida. I don't think, obviously, hope and change isn't going to fly again. It's going to be sort of what Bush and everyone else did for their second term campaign, which is keep the same hand on the rudder. We're coming back. We're doing stronger than we were. You know, things are getting better slowly, I think, is going to be a big part of it. I don't think it's not being Romney. I think also foreign policy. I think he's got a lot of things to point to in foreign policy that will help him in the campaign. But in the end, it's going to be jobs and the economy.
I don't remember hope and change exactly, but you're right, a lot on jobs, and in particular on manufacturing in the State of the Union. Let's go to some of that.
Tonight, I want to speak about how we move forward and lay out a blueprint for an economy that's built to last, an economy built on American manufacturing, American energy, skills for American workers, and a renewal of American values. Now, this blueprint begins with American manufacturing.
American manufacturing, that is a phrase that has not had much of a workout in a while. Major Garrett, how do you interpret that big emphasis there? And what about our caller's sort of skeptical view of the president, wondering what message he can mount that will be effective, you know, after 4 years that haven't been easy as we head toward the fall?
Well, let me take up the manufacturing first. Manufacturing, when the president talks about that, is really a proxy for what he did to rescue the auto industry. I mean, that is going to be one of the key components of the president's argument that intervention, temporary directed intervention by the federal government in a moment of crisis, can produce results that are positive and did produce results that are positive. So when the president speaks broadly of manufacturing, what he really is trying to tell people is, a domestic auto industry was on the brink of collapse. We intervened. The federal government did something it never did before, rescued Chrysler, rescued General Motors. Ford did not need a rescue, but if you check with Alan Mulally, the president and CEO of Ford, he will tell you he supported that intervention, not because Ford needed it, but what Ford needed was the underlying parts suppliers that were kept in business because GM and Chrysler didn't collapse. Mm-hmm. Because he has said publicly, if those parts suppliers, all those in the food chain, if you will, in the manufacturing food chain for Chrysler and GM could not have survived on Ford's business alone, keeping GM and Chrysler alive also kept Ford alive. So that's what the president means. One quick statistic, though, on manufacturing. I went back and looked at this, Tom. The Bureau of Labor Statistics on its website goes back to 1962. The president was born in 61. What was the percentage of manufacturing in the U.S. labor force then? What is it now? In 1962, the percentage of manufacturing in our labor force was 28%. It is now 8%. Okay? That shrinkage of what we make in America and sell to the world is a structural problem that every American president in the last 20 years has tried to deal with. It is a very difficult thing to deal with because once you get involved in trying to boost domestic manufacturing, you are by nature involved in industrial policy. And if you're involved in industrial policy, you're going to have winners and losers. And winners and losers in a political context like that is very difficult. I would serve up to you as example number one, Solyndra.
Solyndra, big problem. But the president bragging on the comeback of the auto industry big time. GM is back at number one. I mean, Jack Beatty, what about his presentation of the economy, his presentation of a solution there? And you hear our callers, sort of had enough attitude here. How do you see Obama opening this week, his campaign season?
Well, what I missed was he didn't really say anything about – he seemed to be talking about a different country than the one we live in. That was my general impression. He talked about a country of possibility, not – he wasn't describing this particular country at this moment. And my view, at least, was crystallized by a two-line letter to the editor of the New York Times. Nice speech, sir, but I still don't have a job. There was nothing in that speech that would get anybody a job, it seemed to me, this year. And since the speech, after all, was a cornucopia of promises and of none of it's going to, very little of it is going to happen, we could have heard something about the unemployed. We could have heard something about changing the nature of the unemployment system so that people can be reskilled.
But he did talk about that. He talked about exactly that, right? We should reskill instead of just he talked about changing the unemployment.
Well yes, he talked about connecting community colleges to employment. He didn't talk about connecting the unemployment compensation system that way, as Newt Gingrich, to his credit, has talked about. Let's make it a chance to people to learn new skills. And the second thing, he didn't say anything really substantial about the major failure of his administration, the housing crisis. You know, all agree, Mark Zandi in today's paper, The Economist, says we can't really have a robust economic recovery without a recovery in housing, and that still hasn't happened. And the levers that he has, you know, talking about going back to allowing bankruptcy judges to cram down mortgages and settlements and so on, he didn't even voice those. It was like, well, his policy seemed to be that of Mitt Romney, which is, we've got to wait till this thing goes down to the bottom and then we'll have a recovery. Well, of course, that's going to limit any dimension of growth. And meanwhile, how does his contrast his view of the economy, all these positive things, with what we're getting out of the Fed? According to one economist, about the Fed's announcement this week, they were going to keep interest rates at zero to the end of 2014. He said, what did we learn today? That things are bad and they are not improving. Meanwhile, at Davos, the headline, pessimism lingers in the air among the economists there. The IMF, they're talking about fertile ground for self-perpetuating pessimism in the economy. Point is, things are bad. The president didn't focus on that at all.
Of course, an incumbent can hardly come out and say, well, things are bad and let's be pessimistic. I mean, Major Garrett, maybe the president's not reaching for those big action levers Jack's talking about because he tried that with Congress and nothing happened. He put out these two big themes: make it fair, make this country fair, and we won't go back to what we saw before the economic collapse. What about those as substructure for his campaign, Major?
Well, they're cautious, and that's the only place the president can be with this domestic economy, is cautious. He can't say, well, look at all these things I've done that have made your life demonstrably and appreciably better, because Americans don't feel that way. Unemployment is persistently high. The number of Americans who've been out of work for more than 27 weeks has never been higher since the Great Depression. This idea of prolonged structural unemployment, where your skills and your sense of participation in the United States labor force first goes into question and then almost evaporates entirely, is now becoming a reality in our labor force. And that's a difficult situation for any incumbent president to be in. The one thing I would say structurally that occurred to me about the speech is he led off and he bracketed. He finished and ended with foreign policy and national security. Real success is there, and I believe you are going to see more and more of that as the president campaigns for reelection, saying, I inherited a great mess economically. We are making steady, though uninspiring, progress. But on the big question you had about me, was I ready? Could I handle this? I have met your expectations. I've exceeded your expectations, the president will argue. And I think Republicans a year ago would have thought foreign policy, national security would have been a lead pipe cinch winner. I don't think they think that anymore.
And then there was this reference to foreign policy or foreign action anyway. On his way down the aisle on Tuesday night for the State of the Union address, the president leaning in toward, listen for this now, it's very short, leaning in toward Defense Secretary Leon Panetta, congratulating him, we didn't know why, presumably for news that had yet to break.
Leon, good job tonight. Good job tonight.
Good job tonight. And the news, of course, coming out that SEAL Team 6 was in action again on Wednesday, the next day, speaking with reporters in the Pentagon. Navy Captain John Kirby confirmed reports of the rescue of captured aid workers, American Jessica Buchanan and Dane Paul Thisted, by the U.S. military. Later, we found out SEAL Team 6 saying they found out about the success of that mission just before the State of the Union address.
We knew that at that point that the shots had been fired, that casualties had been taken among the kidnappers. But more importantly, we knew that the two hostages were safe.
SEAL Team 6, the same outfit that went after and killed bin Laden, though we're told not exactly the same men. Ron in Augusta, Georgia. Ron, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
This lady, Miss Buchanan, aid worker, the news media hasn't gone into any detail as to what she was doing, what aid was she providing. I guess my point is, if she's not affiliated with the federal government or our military in any way,
mm-hmm.
are we going to regulate our SEAL team, our most elite group in the Army, to doing kidnap retrieval work? Is this part of the whole policing the world situation with government dollars, with taxpayer dollars? Could you clarify what she was doing?
Well, that's very interesting. Now, as I recall it, and I don't have it right in front of me here, but I think it was a Danish group working with refugees there. This was in a remote part of Somalia. These were sort of related to pirate outfits, I think, that took them captive last fall. And the word was that her health, the U.S. somehow learned that her health was deteriorating and made the decision to go in. But Jack Beatty, this is an interesting question raised here. This is our very most elite military arm. And, you know, Major says, watch out, you're going to see more in foreign policy this week. It seemed almost accidental that the president was talking about it as he went down the aisle for a State of the Union address. But on the other hand, this administration has made hay, rightly, but made hay out of the bin Laden killing. Is there a temptation to keep pulling out this super elite arm, you know, for sort of a superhero operations that cast a fine light, indeed, if you're for that sort of thing on the White House, Jack?
It certainly sounds that way, doesn't it? And the spotlight given to Admiral Bill McRaven, who's in charge of the Worldwide Theater Special Operations Command, which is the facility, you know, the entity that runs these programs. He was spotlighted at the State of the Union, and his command, I see by the new Pentagon budget, is going to get more money. While we're cutting back 80,000 soldiers in the Army, we're going to boost this special forces capacity. And you know, our caller raises a good question: is this what we want our military to do, to go around saving people? My own view is it was pretty, you know, that's a pretty good investment. We're not mired in a war there. It doesn't look like we're trying to be the world's policeman. I mean, Teddy Roosevelt, after all, sent a squadron of Marines to Morocco to get a hostage. This seems to me to be a pretty good use of force.
Lucky for Miss Buchanan, certainly, and her Danish compatriot there. But a reasonable question. I don't want to go away without hearing once more from Gabby Giffords. We hope to hear from her again. That incredible, terrible attack on her out with her constituents a year ago, and now her leaving Congress. She first announced in a web video this week that she would resign as congressional representative for Arizona's 8th District. Here she is saying she would devote more time to her recovery.
Thank you for your prayers and for giving me time to recover. I have more work to do on my recovery. So, to do what is best for Arizona, I will step down this week.
And on the floor of the House, Democratic National Committee Chairwoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz this week read Gabby Giffords, the Congresswoman's resignation letter to the House, and added her own tearful goodbye to her friend.
No matter what we argue about here on this floor or in this country, there is nothing more important than family and friendship. And that should be held on high above all else. And I will always carry that in my heart. And even though I know we won't see each other every day, Gabby, we will be friends for life.
Emotion high as Gabby Giffords leaves Congress there. Carl Hiaasen, I mean, that was just a terrible, bloody, unforgettable event that took Gabby Giffords down a year ago. Your thoughts on her departing Congress now?
Well, it was just a marvelous thing to see the other night, and it was heartwarming to see everybody standing and everybody on the same page with tears in their eyes. It showed you that we can elevate ourselves above this swamp of partisanship when the right moment is here.
Above the swamp of partisanship, and certainly above the bloody swamp of violence that we saw on that day, a terrible day, good thing for everybody to meditate on and stay away from. Carl Hiaasen, author of Star Island Nature Girl, coming out Chomp next month with the Miami Herald. We'll be watching on Tuesday, Carl. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Major Garrett with the National Journal. Thank you, Merritt. Major.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
Jack Beatty, have a great weekend, Jack.
Thank you.
This is On Point.